Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Adam Montgomery for the murder of his daughter, Harmony Montgomery, from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Courtroom coverage continues now.
The court finds that he is qualified as an expert.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. McMahon, what was your involvement into the investigation into the death of Harmony Montgomery?
I was assigned as the point person, at least as far as any requests that were made by the Manchester Police Department for testing or examination of evidence for biological materials, primarily in this case, blood or hairs.
I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the evidence that you did do serology testing or at least examinations on in this case. It's my understanding that several of the items that you examined had no stain that you saw, nothing to be tested. Is that correct?
That's correct. There were a number of items that I examined and did not find any stains or deposits that I felt were characteristic of blood. And so no further testing was done beyond a mere physical examination.
And then were there other items that you looked at that you did test, but it turned out that they were negative for blood?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Were there also an item or two that you tested that was positive for blood?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I'd like to start then, understanding that those are three categories of things that you found. I want to start with some of the evidence that you tested that did not have blood on them, things that were examined and tested, but then did not have blood. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What pieces of evidence did you test that you found out that they did not have blood on them? And I'd like to start specifically with items that you tested on January 5th of 2022, that you wrote in a report on January 5th of 2022. And would you like me to refer to the item names the numbers that have been assigned to those items? Or do you have a copy of your reports available in case you need to refresh your recollection?
I have a copy of my entire case report, so you can either refer to the date of the report or the exhibit number so that I can verify what you're asking me.
And let me ask you, did you sit through a deposition, Mr. McMahon, on the same case?
I did.
And that the same file that you have with you today, is that the one that you had at deposition when you were able to answer Attorney Smith's questions on that day?
Yes, sir.
Any objection, Attorney Smith, to having him refer to his notes?
No.
Okay. So, Mr. McMahon, let me ask you specifically about a test that you did on an item listed as JMT8. JMT8. And first of all, what was the description that you had for that item?
It was a section of automobile carpeting, not from the passenger compartment, but from the trunk of an automobile.
And let me ask, we're talking about JMT8. Did you ever meet a detective by the name of Joseph Tucker from the Manchester Police Department?
I'm sorry, what did you ask me?
Did you ever meet a detective by the name of Joseph Tucker from the Manchester Police Department?
I did not.
Okay. The testing on JMT8, what were the serological tests that you performed on that, and what was the results?
Well, I performed a physical examination of this piece of carpeting by putting some white paper, some bench paper, down on my examination bench, and then taking this section of carpeting out of its original container, laying it out on the bench, and examining it under the normal room lights. and maybe with the assistance of a flashlight, did not see any staining on there that I thought was suggestive of blood. But knowing that dark-colored substrates, like this carpeting, which was black, I then employed the use of an infrared light source. It's basically another source of light, but rather than white light that we use for room lighting, it employs infrared light, and the image of the what the camera is seeing is projected on a computer tablet. And during the course of this particular examination, I happen to notice a dark-colored stain that was not visible under normal room lighting. And I tested that for the presence of blood, and that test was negative.
Did you also test another item with the same initials, JMT5, a T-shirt?
I did.
Okay. And similarly, what were the results on the test on the T-shirt?
In that case, I performed an analysis of a number of stains that were on that T-shirt, and I employed a test that would detect the presence of blood, and each of those tests were negative.
And finally, at one point, did you also, I'm referring to a report that you wrote on June 15th of 2022, or 13th was a correction on the 15th, did you ever do an examination of a piece of evidence entitled JD-47, an igloo cooler?
I did.
Okay. And what testing did you perform on that piece of evidence?
Again, the testing always begins with a physical examination for deposits which you believe are reflective of or suggestive of blood. There were a number of stains on this particular cooler that seemed to resemble dried blood stains. Each of those was tested chemically in the laboratory by myself, and each of those tests were negative for blood.
And with regards to that cooler, could you generally describe what it looked like?
It's a large red igloo portable cooler. It has wheels on it, so it can easily be transported if it's full of ice or other things. And it has a red body. It has a white lid on it and a white liner. And I believe it has a retractable black metal handle on it, like a wheeled suitcase would.
Your Honor, if I can approach the witness, please.
Yes.
Mr. McMahon, I'm going to put down in front of you, marked as State's Exhibit 73. I'm going to lift the lid for a moment and just ask you whether or not you recognize the item that is inside.
Yes, I do.
What do you recognize that item to be?
That is Exhibit JD-47, the igloo cooler.
So this is the one that you tested?
Yes, sir.
And could you please just tell us generally, where did you test this item?
If I might refer to my notes.
Yes, please.
So I tested a number of stained areas, seven different areas.
I'm sorry, did you say seven different areas?
Seven different areas.
Okay.
One stain on the bottom of the base, another stain on the right side of the base of the white top edge, another stain on the red plastic base at the right front corner, another stain at the left side of the base near the white top edge. The fifth stain was on the left side of the lid on the edge. Sixth was on the right front of the lid at the edge. And the seventh stain was on the right side of the lid at the edge. I drew a diagram to assist me in detecting where on the lid I actually.
And with regards to each one of those tests, were all of those in fact negative for the presence of blood?
Yes, sir.
Injection leading.
What was your conclusion with regards to the test on those seven areas?
Each of the results of each of the tests that I performed on those seven areas were negative for the presence of blood.
Thank you. In this case, did Manchester Police Department ever inform you that some of the items had been treated, for example, let's say JMT8, the stain in the trunk, did they ever tell you that some of these had been treated with a product by the name of Blue Star?
Yes.
And let me ask, does Blue Star interfere with the serological testing that you do?
In and of itself, it does not.
Okay. Does it interfere with the DNA testing of these samples?
It reportedly does not.
What's the testing method that you use when you're testing for the presence of blood?
Well, in the laboratory, I would use a test that's known as the Castle-Meyer test, KASTLE-MEYER, Castle-Meyer.
What advantage, if any, does the Castle-Meyer test have over a test like Blue Star?
Well, the benefit of the Castle-Meyer test over a test like Blue Star or some other tests similar to it is that the Castle-Meyer test enjoys a reputation of being both very sensitive and fairly specific. None of these blood detection tests are 100% specific, which means that occasionally they will provide you with a positive result, but it's actually a false positive result. The result that you're getting that you would ordinarily think is positive is in fact a false positive, and it's due to something in the sample that you're testing that you're unaware of.
So with regards to the Castle-Meyer test, is that the test that the New Hampshire State Police Forensic Laboratory uses?
It is.
How long have you been using that test? How familiar are you with that test?
I've been using the Castle-Meyer test since college, and on day one in my introduction into forensic serology testing at the State Police Lab back in 1983.
Does the New Hampshire State Police Forensic Lab use Blue Star?
We do not.
Why not?
We prefer to use a different chemical for trying to find traces of blood at crime scenes. We use a chemical that's known as luminol.
And with regards to the concept of false positives, could you explain what false positives are when it comes to serology testing?
Well, in testing for the presence of blood, the tests that are available to us to detect the presence of blood all rely upon detecting the presence of hemoglobin. In order for a screening test or a detection test to be of any value, it must test for something that's unique in whatever you're looking for. And the one thing that's unique about blood compared to other body fluids is blood has hemoglobin in it, where saliva and semen and other body fluids do not. So all of the blood detection tests rely upon detecting the presence of hemoglobin. And in the Castle-Meyer test, we add a drop of a reagent that's made up of a chemical called phenolphthalein, and we look for a color change at that point. If, in fact, any of the known or well-recognized false positives are present in your sample, very often, you'll see a reaction immediately after adding the phenolphthalein where you shouldn't. It's only after adding the second reagent, hydrogen peroxide, should you see a color change. And in the Castle-Meyer test, we're looking for the formation of a pink color. So if, in fact, I'm testing something for the presence of blood, and I get that pink color after merely adding the testing agent.
Yeah.
The phenolphthalein. If I get a pink color there, that's a warning to me that the test isn't over yet. It's only halfway through. Yet you're getting this pink color, and that would be considered a false positive reaction. It doesn't happen very often, but when it does, you're quite taken back because you're not expecting to see that color so soon. It's only after adding the hydrogen peroxide that you should see the color form, if in fact blood is present. If no color forms, then you can safely conclude that blood is not present.
The hemoglobin that you're trying to detect, what does the first part of that heme, what does heme stand for?
Well, the hemoglobin molecule is fairly large and complex, and a major portion of it contains an iron atom. And that's the heme portion of the hemoglobin molecule, the part that contains the iron.
The part that contains the iron.
That's correct.
Okay. I'd like to now move on to some of the other evidence that you tested, understanding that. Did you test a section of drywall and a T-beam framing in this case that you referred to in your June 13th and then 15th report of 2022?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Specifically, did you test a piece that was entitled MER3D1, a piece of T-bar framing?
Yes.
Did you also test a piece called MER3D-3B-1, a swab?
Yes.
Okay. And also, did you test any sort of cutting from a backing of a piece of drywall?
Yes, I did.
Could you please explain to the jury how you came to examine this exhibit, made that cutting, and then made those tests, or conducted those tests?
This large item of evidence was submitted to the laboratory and was opened up by my colleague, criminalist Martin Orlowitz. He was preparing to process this item of evidence for latent fingerprints. But knowing that there was another request for looking for blood stains, I was called over to conduct that examination prior to his analyses. And after I had examined that item of evidence, I had found several areas that I had suspected that were possibly blood. And so I went about testing several of those areas for the presence of blood using the Castle-Mayer test. And each of the areas that I tested positive for blood.
Before you did that testing, you described before how you would do a physical examination of an item. Did you do that before you decided what areas to test?
Oh, yes.
Okay. And at any point, did you label anything on that piece of drywall, on that backing?
I did. So that it would be clear, if need be down the road, like today, to know exactly where I tested or I took my samples for testing. Every area that I performed a test on a sample from was numbered.
Okay. Numbered or lettered?
Well, in the cases of the deposits on the metal frame, they were each given a number. And then on the backside of the drywall portion of the exhibit, there was a very large discoloration, a stain that consisted of light and darker areas. And I elected to test four different parts of that one large stain. And that got not only a number, but a number five, but also a letter, A, B, C, or D.
A, B, C, or D? So it was four, correct?
That's correct.
All right. And I believe, but if you could please go ahead and I think you may have already said this, what were your conclusions of testing those areas, whether they were positive for the presence of blood?
Each of those areas and everything I tested in that particular exhibit was positive for the presence of blood.
You stated that you were working with somebody else that day at the state lab. Could you say that name again?
Criminalist, that's his title, Martin Orlowitz. Okay.
And with regards to Criminalist Orlowitz, what unit of the lab does he work in?
He works in the pattern evidence unit.
I'd like to ask some of the samples that you took or the parts that you were able to cut out and make cuttings. Did you submit those for further DNA analysis inside the lab?
Yes. I swabbed the blood deposits that were on the metal frame because that was the most effective way of removing the blood from that metal surface by transferring it to a swab that had been moistened with something called digest buffer. As far as the stained area on the backing of the drywall, that had soaked into this very thin cardboard backing, and swabbing it would not have been as effective. And so what I did was I took a sterile scalpel, and I very carefully cut out a small square of the darkest stain on that cardboard backing of the drywall. I put that cutting into a coin envelope, and that coin envelope and the swabbings from the metal parts of the exhibit were forwarded to our DNA unit for DNA testing.
How did you label that cutting that went to the DNA unit for DNA testing, and how did you label the swab that went on for DNA testing?
So the cutting would have been labeled, if I might refer to my notes again.
Please do.
So as far as the metal swabbing, and I only took one of the four that I had available to me, I selected one as a representative sample, and the actual stain on the exhibit was exhibit MER3B, and because this was now somewhat of a child of that, this swab was now MER-3B-1. As far as the cutting is concerned, again, it's the same exhibit, so it's going to be exhibit MER-3B. But this was that large stain area, which I called collectively stain 5, but then subcategorized each of the four stains in there is A, B, C, and D. And so the stain that went on for, or a portion of it that went on for DNA testing, because I didn't cut the whole stain out. The stain was large enough that I could cut out about a 1-inch square from the middle of it and still leave the rest of it behind. That I identified as MER-3B-5A.
Thank you. The DNA testing that you sent it along for, did you perform that testing yourself or someone else?
I did
else?
Not.
Do you remember who that was that did do that testing?
That was performed by my colleague, criminalist Katie Swango.
And finally, Mr. McMahon, with regards to, I know we talked about a couple of specific items. It's my understanding that there were many other items that you swabbed and checked for serology. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And with regards to those, were those either ones where no blood was found or that after a physical examination there was no stain to test? With regards to the physical items, not hairs. So excuse me, I think anything other than the hairs that you were provided.
So that would be correct. All the other items that I looked at, with maybe the exception of two, either did not find blood on them, or my testing of what looked like it could be blood was negative.
And with regards to the two that you thought that you might have located blood, let me ask, was one of them, to your recollection, a sweatshirt or a portion of a sweatshirt?
I think it was portion of a sweater.
Okay. A portion of a sweater. If
yes.
You could refer to your notes, I just want to make sure that we're clear.
Yes, the two items that I'm referring to are exhibits JP216, which is a pink sweater, and this is detailed in my report dated April 21st.
And JP216, so that's the first two initials there are JP, is that
That's correct.
Okay. And with regards to that sweatshirt, do you know what kind of vehicle that came out of, whether or not it was an Audi that came out of? Are you aware of that?
I don't know what the source of where the item was collected from, but it's a sweater.
Sweater, okay. And was there? You said there was one other item. Could you please tell us what that one was?
The other one was JP251, which was a length of twine.
And that also was a JP, I believe you said, those initials?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And do you know whether that came out of a blue Audi or do you? Similar to your last answer, you don't know where that item came from.
I do not know.
All right. If I can just have a moment, please, Your Honor.
Yes. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
The New Hampshire State Lab has a separate DNA lab, right?
That's correct.
And do you do DNA?
I do not.
Okay. And one of the reasons that things don't go directly to DNA is DNA kind of costs a lot of money, and you want to make sure that the testing is of something that may produce a DNA result.
That's correct. The vast majority of evidence that comes to the laboratory with a request to check for blood or semen or saliva typically goes through a serological examination first. And if we find something, usually only a portion of the original item gets forwarded on for DNA testing, not the entire item. We'll cut a stain out of a garment or out of a piece of drywall, like I just explained to you. When I don't find any type of a biological material, then that's where the analysis ends.
Okay.
And nothing would go on to DNA.
Right, because if it doesn't get through you, there's likely not DNA.
That's correct.
And that a DNA test would be a waste.
That's correct.
So, that's not always the case that it goes through you, right?
Well, the vast majority of it is the vast majority of the evidence is subjected to some sort of a serological analysis by either myself or a colleague of mine.
Okay.
There are some items that would go straight to DNA, like a known DNA sample of one person or another. There's no need to perform any analysis on an item of evidence, which is a known sample from a known individual.
Okay. I'm going to show you a copy of what's been marked as State's Exhibit 10. Have you seen this object before?
I have not.
Okay. And this is a full exhibit, Your Honor.
Yes.
A toothbrush. There's been testimony about DNA tested in the lab and results found on the toothbrush. Why was it that didn't go through you?
I'm not sure if I can answer that. I could only surmise that for serological or biological testing, the area of interest in that particular item is so small. We're not looking for DNA on the parts of the handle. We're looking for DNA only on the part that goes into the person's mouth and makes contact with their teeth and gums. And that was so small, and the fear would be that there would be very little DNA present because it's a small surface area. And so rather than wasting sample on a serological test, because we're going to do DNA testing regardless, let's just reserve all of the sample for DNA testing. There are a few situations where even though my testing is negative, The item still goes on for DNA testing. And that's a few situations, and it's only done because we recognize that the sensitivity of the test that I perform is much lower than the sensitivity of a DNA test. So when I swab the mouth of a bottle that was left behind at a crime scene, and I test that swabbing for saliva and it's negative, that swabbing would still go on for DNA.
And essentially, we are talking about saliva, and that the area of interest on a toothbrush would be saliva.
Right? That's correct.
And so pretty much no matter what, that's going to the DNA lab.
Yes, ma'am.
And so this isn't simply a procedure where people are doing things by rote. You actually consider the possibility of whether testing might consume DNA before DNA can actually be tested?
That's correct.
And if there's the possibility of that, you're going to send it straight for testing so that your tests don't consume or have any effect on the DNA that might be present?
That's correct.
To make sure that if it's there, it's going to be found?
Yes, ma'am.
There you had some testimony about JMT evidence, starting with the initials JMT.
Yes, ma'am.
And that was a section of black carpet, a child's T-shirt, and a child's pajama pants, right? Go ahead.
Yes.
Okay. And those, I think you were aware, were found in the trunk of a car?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. And the same area where the toothbrush was found?
That I'm not sure I was aware of at the time.
Okay. And so you tested each of these items, and they were all negative for blood?
That's correct.
And you talked about the testing, that if you saw a stain that looked like it might be blood, then you would take the next step and do some screening with the chemical.
That's correct.
In the black carpet, because a stain might be there and you might miss it, you do extra tests, right?
Right, that's when we re-examine the item using the infrared light source. That's correct.
So you don't assume, okay, I can't see anything, you're going to make sure that it's not there.
That's only done when the color of the substrate, the surface that possible blood is on, is dark enough that it might, by virtue of its dark color, interfere with my ability to see the blood stain. Items that are lighter colored, it would just get a standard physical examination under normal room lighting.
So the next step, after you question perhaps there's something there, you do that Castle
Mayor
testing. And the black section of carpet from the trunk was negative for blood. The child's T-shirt, you checked that for, you examined it by sight to check for stains, right?
That's correct.
And you found several.
Yes.
And you tested them to see if those stains were just child stains or blood.
Well, I'm not sure I would describe it that way, but there are a number of stains on a green sweatshirt.
Turquoise, perhaps?
Okay. I wasn't exactly sure which one you were speaking about.
All right. JMT5?
Okay. I was thinking of another item, but yeah. I conducted an examination of it, again, if I might refer to my notes. I conducted a physical examination of this child's T-shirt, and because the sleeves of the T-shirt were dark blue, the body of the shirt was this turquoise, I conducted an additional physical exam using the infrared light source and looking for additional staining on the sleeves.
And so that was negative for the presence of blood.
That's correct.
And then there was pajama pants, a child's pajama pants found in the same area?
That's correct. And well, I'm not sure where it was the collected location. From.
Okay, sorry. JMT6, that one you didn't have to go to the Castlemyre testing, right?
I did not.
Because you could see the item well enough to determine if there were stains characteristic of blood.
Well, in this case, like some of the other items, these pajama pants were dark gray in color. And so after examining them under normal room lighting, I conducted a re-examination using the infrared light source. And I didn't find any staining on these pajama pants at all.
So it's pretty fair to say that if there's a question in your mind, you take another step.
If one is available.
So then you did several items that had the initials at the beginning, JP.
Yes.
And there's been testimony before you that JP was, and you understand that the initials reflect the officer that has collected and bagged or whatever the evidence.
I do. That's a common practice in law enforcement.
And there has been testimony that was JP referred to an officer Pittman, and these items were from the Audi. Were you aware of that?
At that time, no.
Okay. And same sort of testing to determine whether or not there was a presence of blood.
That's correct.
And if there was a question in your observation, you would take the next step and check for either a light source or the Castlemyre.
That's correct.
And the results were a little bit mixed. Some you did not find the presence of blood. Some you had to do additional screening for blood.
That's correct.
And two items I think that you testified of, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, about 15 items that were JP something.
Do you want me to double check your math?
We can do approximates if you want.
Well, excluding hairs. I can only find 9 that are JP.
Are you looking at your report of 1/20/22? And then
yep, there's two items there.
Pardon?
Two items there.
4/21/22? Oh, the next one's 1/26/22?
Yep, those are the hairs.
Okay. And then 4/21/22.
Seven items there.
7, 8, 9, 10, 13. Total.
But you're including the hairs.
Yes.
Okay. 14.
Okay. Good thing.
14 in total.
Okay. And speaking of the hairs, you found one specimen, and it's a JP hair, one specimen suitable for DNA analysis and send it on, right?
With respect to JP185, yes.
And then with respect to JP202, a couple of hairs to go to the DNA.
That's correct.
And other hairs didn't actually have any DNA in them.
Well,
or you couldn't detect.
No. I guess for the remaining hairs, based upon my microscopical examination of the hairs, I had determined that they were likely unsuitable for a DNA analysis.
Okay. So then you also testified on direct about a pink woman's sweater screening positive for blood, right?
That's correct.
A length of twine, which was JP251, screening positive for blood?
That's correct.
And you sent those two on for DNA analysis?
That's correct.
And if these items were found in a motor vehicle that had been sitting out in the weather for a very long time, subject to heat, subject to cold, and subject to mold, apparently, you were still able to find presence of blood on those items.
That's correct.
And environment can degrade blood or DNA?
Possibly, yes.
And it may not?
That's correct.
And so the fact that something has been in the environment doesn't mean that any blood that's been there has degraded.
That's correct.
And the fact that something has been subject to heat and cold doesn't mean that any blood that had been present would be degraded.
That's correct.
Thank you. I think. One moment, Your Honor, please. Oh, and one more thing was you talked about the area of dry paneling that was sent on to the DNA lab as well. Drywall paneling.
Yes, ma'am.
Paneling, ceiling, I don't know what to call it. Drywall, you have it as drywall paneling, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And if there's testimony that this was taken from a ceiling, would that be consistent with your description?
Yes, although I couldn't describe it in my notes or in my report as a part of a ceiling because that's assuming I knew where it came from and I can't take that assumption into account. So I just describe what it is as it's presented before me.
Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honor, just for the table. Mr. McMahon, just on that last line of questioning you were just asked about not being able to take it for granted that the drywall that you saw necessarily came from the ceiling, is that something where to be able to say that you'd have to talk to the person that actually took it from the ceiling or took it from a wall?
I'd either have to be there during its collection. I'd have to get its source or from where it came from someone whose opinion I trusted. Or a third option would for it to be described that way when it was submitted to the laboratory on the paperwork that's submitted with evidence. But I'm still the final say for how an item is described. That may have come from a ceiling, and I'm certain it probably did. It's just that wasn't so apparently obvious to me that I had to describe it as what it actually was.
Thank you for that. Two other quick questions for you. You were asked a moment ago about JMT5, the T-shirt, and I believe you described how cross-examination that the sleeves were darker, that dark substrate that you talked about earlier, and that's where you used the infrared light.
That's correct.
Did you make any notation the fact that that T-shirt was sized for an 18-month-old?
I did make a notation in my notes where I can about the garment manufacturer's name and the size. And again, I'm referring to my notes. I described exhibit JMT5 as a blue/teal long sleeve T-shirt. And Furthermore, it's a children's long sleeve T-shirt with a turquoise colored body and dark blue sleeves. The brand name is Just One U, and the size was 18M.
About the toothbrush with regards to that going not through serology but directly to DNA. And I believe that you were asked whether or not the toothbrush would have saliva on it, that a small part of the toothbrush would have saliva on it. Do you recall that question a moment ago?
To some degree, yes.
In addition to the saliva, would it also have cheek cells or other cells from the gum or the line?
It's inferred that it would. I mean, it's a motorized toothbrush. Assuming that we use it in the fashion for which it was intended, it's reasonable to expect that the end of the toothbrush that you would insert into your mouth could bear deposits of saliva, and that saliva would contain cellular material from the gums or from the cheeks of the mouth.
Thank you very much. I have no further questions.
Just also very, very quickly, the turquoise child's long sleeve T-shirt you said was specifically what age? 18 months?
Well, it said 18M on the fabric label.
Okay. So toddler-ish.
I assume so, yes.
Okay. And the pajama pants similarly?
May I look at my notes?
Sure.
One pair of dark gray fleece children's sleep pants with a red, white, and black winter holiday pattern. The brand was Holiday, pound sign or hashtag, if you will, FamJams, FamJams, size XS4/5.
And I take it you're not going to interpret what that size means, but it's
extra small.
Okay.
And I'm guessing 4 or 5 in children's clothing typically refers to the approximate age of the child that would wear that size clothing.
Okay. And the pink sweater was an adult woman's sweater.
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any objection?
Yes.
May I be excused?
You may.
But sir, you may step down. You are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's 2:30, perfect timing for our mid-afternoon break. So I remind you, don't discuss the case with each other. Don't do any independent research. I'm going to ask the witness, if you would, just to stay there for just a moment so I can let the jurors go. We'll see you in about 15 minutes. All rise for the jury, please. Thank you, sir. You can step down. Counsel, please, for just a minute.
And how did you label?
All right. Please rise for the jurors. Please be seated. State may call its next witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. The state calls Martin Orlowitz to the stand. You swear that the testimony that you're about to provide this jury will be the truth and the whole truth under the pains and penalties of perjury.
I do.
Thank you. You can have a seat. Make yourself comfortable. Mr. Orlowitz, can you start by stating and spelling your full name for the record?
My name is Martin Orlowitz, MartinOrlowicz.
And Mr. Orlowitz, how are you present here for?
I work for the State of New Hampshire State Police Forensic Laboratory.
What's your current position with the Forensic Laboratory?
I'm a latent print examiner.
And how long have you worked for the State of New Hampshire the New Hampshire State Lab?
Since October of 2019.
And prior to that, any experience with the Forensic Laboratory?
I worked from October of 2016 to July of 2019. I worked for the State of Alaska Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory.
And how long were you with the Alaska State Crime Lab?
Between October 2016 and July 2019, so almost 3 years.
What was the role that you held while you were working, while you were employed at the Alaska State Crime Lab?
I was doing latent print processing as well as crime scene processing for the lab.
And when you say crime scene processing, what did that look like when you were at the Alaska State Crime Lab?
The crime scene processing that I did for the State of Alaska was a accessory role where law enforcement would call for an assist if they needed specialty work done at a crime scene, searching for fingerprints or tire tracks or blood, those sorts of things.
And was that for the entire state, so all the way from Utqiagvik up north to Ketchikan down south?
Yes, it was.
You also mentioned latent print analysis?
Yes.
And did you do that in your current role or in your role with the Alaska State Crime Lab or both?
My role in Alaska was more specifically just latent print processing, which was evidence processing to search for latent prints or fingerprints, as they're more colloquially known. In New Hampshire, I do the second portion of latent print processing, which is the analysis and comparison.
And which unit for the State of New Hampshire, which units have you worked in?
The name of my unit is the Pattern Evidence Unit.
What are your primary duties and responsibilities in that unit?
In New Hampshire, I'm doing latent print processing, so processing evidence to find fingerprints or friction ridge evidence, as well as doing the comparisons, so analyzing any impressions that I find to determine if they're of value for comparison, and then comparing them to known record impressions to see if I can determine the source that they may have come from.
Mr. Orlowitz, what areas do you specialize in at the state lab?
Just fingerprints.
And I want to talk about your background, your training. Can you tell us what your educational background is?
I have a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of New Hampshire in biology. That's my educational experience. Outside of that, my training specific to my duties, I went through roughly a 6-month program in the State of Alaska to learn how to process evidence for latent prints. And then when I moved to New Hampshire and started at the lab here, I went through roughly another 10-month training program to do the analysis and comparison portion. This training program is sort of like a residency program, so it's shadowing personnel who are already employed at the laboratory while doing my own independent research and study in those areas to become competent, and then there's final competency exams before I'm allowed to do any independent work.
And you mentioned your Bachelor's of Science. What year did you obtain that degree?
2015.
I want to talk about the New Hampshire State Police training program for friction ridge detail. Are you familiar with that program?
Yes.
And can you tell the jurors what it is?
So that was the residency program that I was just describing. So it's an in-depth program where any trainee, myself included, who goes through is learning about friction ridge processing, analysis, and comparison for an extended period of time in order to become competent in the field.
And Mr. Erlewitz, do you currently hold any certifications in your field?
I do.
Can you tell the jurors what that is?
I have a certification from the International Association for Identification for latent print examining.
Can you also tell the jurors what you have to do to become a latent print examiner?
In order to, there's an application process to take the certification test. So I had to put together a packet showing my experience and training in the field, as well as showing that I was currently employed in the field and doing latent print comparisons. I believe the certification mandates that at least you have to have at least 2 years experience doing latent print comparisons before you can take the certification test. So that was submitted to the certification board, and then when they deemed that I met the qualifications for the test, they sent the written and practical portions of the test, which I completed and passed.
When did you obtain that certification? What year?
2021.
And Mr. Erlewitz, about how many fingerprints would you say you've personally examined over the course of your career, both here and in Alaska?
Thousands.
Is the New Hampshire State Police Forensic Laboratory accredited?
Yes.
And can you tell the jurors what that accreditation is?
Our accreditation is through the American National Accreditation Board. It's a third-party company, essentially, that reviews any work policies at our laboratory and makes sure that they are meeting industry standard, and then also makes sure that we are adhering to those policies in our day-to-day work. They come through every 4 years for an on-site review and every 2 years, I believe, for a document review to make sure that we can hold our accreditation for the laboratory.
And Mr. Erlewitz, as part of your role with the lab, do you have to undergo continuing education?
Yes.
And can you tell the jurors what that is, what that requirement is?
So in order to maintain my certification through the IAI, I have to have a minimum number of continuing education credits in each 4 year period between my certification tests. So I'm routinely searching for new courses to help bolster my training and experience that in regards to latent prints.
How often would you say you undergo those new courses that you mentioned?
I'm actually in one right now, so fairly often.
Fairly often.
Yes.
Mr. Erlewitz, have you ever been qualified as an expert in fingerprint and palm print analysis in a superior court here in New Hampshire?
Yes.
How many times?
Once that I remember off the top of my head.
And how about a superior court in Alaska?
Not for fingerprint analysis, no.
Your Honor, at this point, the state moves to have criminalist Erlewitz qualified as an expert in the field of fingerprint and palm print identification.
Any objection?
I have no objection to him giving his opinion.
The court finds him so qualified.
Mr. Erlewitz, before we move on, I want to talk about, I want to teach the jurors exactly what fingerprint, palm print analysis is.
Okay.
Have you had an opportunity to look at several slides, demonstrative slides?
Yes.
Do you feel like those slides would aid the jurors in understanding what you do, exactly what it is that you do?
Yes, I do.
Your Honor, at this point, permission to publish several slides.
May we approach?
Yes.
No.
Okay, thank you.
More continuing coverage of the trial of Adam Montgomery for the murder of his daughter Harmony Montgomery is on the way. Press subscribe so you don't miss a moment. from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.